Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how Flagstaff officials are hoping to prevent wildfires on Mount Humphrey. But first, the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services this year embarked on a new pilot program called Wasteful and Inappropriate Service Reduction, or WISER. Arizona is one of six states taking part in the initial rollout, which is scheduled to run through 2031. The WISER model uses AI, among other technologies, to help determine whether or not certain procedures or courses of treatment are appropriate for Medicare patients. Reporting from the Washington Post has found the rollout of the new system of prior authorization has not been smooth across all the states where it's being used. And an effort by some congressional Democrats to repeal or to fund the pilot recently failed. My next guest has seen some of the problems with WISER firsthand. Dr. Matthew Crooks is an interventional pain management doctor and director of interventional pain management with Ortho Arizona. He's also president of the Arizona Society of Interventional Pain Physicians. He says before WISER, he didn't need to get prior authorizations for Medicare patients for minimally invasive procedures. Although if CMS ultimately decided those procedures weren't necessary, he may not get reimbursed for it. He also points out he and his colleagues are used to getting prior authorization for other patients, including those on commercial insurance. I spoke with Dr. Crooks earlier and asked what his experience has been working with WISER.
So when we initially first heard about WISER, coming up to be implemented, which was summer of last year, I myself, and I think a lot of the interventional pain doc community here in Arizona, knowing that we were one of the states where the implementation was going to take place, we were relatively optimistic because we were kind of hoping that we would be involved in the process and that, we recognize that, in all of medicine and, with limited budgets and resources with Medicare, that curbing any sort of waste or fraud is paramount. And as leaders of the field and the clinicians and specialists, we could help to take a forefront in that while still taking great care of our patients. As we got closer to the implementation date of January 2026, some concerning, things developed in that, really we were kind of in the dark about it completely from when we first heard about it to basically go live date in January. So there was very little ability to prepare and to sort of meet expectations of the program. After implementation, I would say it was pretty rocky across the board. There was a period of time when it was first implemented in mid-January where we were getting just a tremendous amount of denials of requests for authorization with the program.
So is the biggest issue then that procedures that you would like to do for your patients are being denied on the front end or taking a long time to get them authorized and delaying the care?
Exactly. Yep. So that's how things played out, is that especially early on, and things have gotten better, I must say, but still it is very different than it was prior to WISER. It slowed down access to care. It's in some cases, it really shut down access to care. When we went from, a patient that when we saw them, we could get them the treatment that they needed within a week, even it then, dragged it out several weeks. And in the case of having denials of care, it would be even longer or even not at all.
Why do you think it is that you were getting so many denials up front?
So we questioned that ourselves, and because it wasn't practice specific to mine, or even talking with multiple different practices, it was pretty uniform, and we were basically following the same blueprint or playbook that we always had in terms of next step of care. And then now all of a sudden the denials are happening. And so what we saw was there was a great disconnect between the third party authorization company that we had in Arizona and Medicare itself. Now there's different third party authorization companies for each of the WISER states. So there's multiple states where this is, you know, we're kind of considered the test state or the rollout of this. And so kind of states to state, it varied quite a bit.
And to be clear, these are treatments that prior to WISeR had been approved?
Tried and true. Yes. So they didn't require approval ahead of time. But, you know, for our sake, as the physician practice, there was no prior authorization requirement. But, you know, if we were not following Medicare guidelines, then we as, you know, physicians or as practice owners run the risk of getting the right procedure for the right patient clinically, but it's not following Medicare guidelines. So then Medicare could either not reimburse us or reimburse us and then come back and take it back.
What role do you think AI has played in what's been going on with WISeR?
So that's, you know, that is the, I guess the $64,000 question, right? Because they say that there is a human kind of overreading all of the authorization requests. Definitely AI is baked into the cake and is, for transparency, part of the process that they, you know, that they are promising, and that there's that should lead to potentially efficiencies, right? But the downside to it is that there are definitely aspects that we're seeing that are, you know, clearly a computer is our notes are, you know, our documentation notes requesting authorization are being fed through AI, and there are things. I will say that part of the reason why things have improved is because we've learned basically what we have to document that was different than before this, and so we've basically adapted our learning to what is required by AI, and it, clearly that there's software that is, you know, if you want to look at the glass as half empty, there's software that is kind of dictating care in some ways.
Well, it's an interesting juxtaposition in some ways, because while the federal government is using AI in this WISeR pilot, a number of states are passing laws specifically saying that AI cannot be used to deny claims or that kind of thing. So I'm wondering, just sort of philosophically, like, do you think there is a role for AI in this kind of thing?
I think that there is on both sides, on both the government side to, I mean, specifically to really, if they can fine tune it. And unfortunately, we're kind of in that pilot program phase in Arizona. But to look at it optimistically, we do want, you know, we want to be able to preserve these procedures for the patients for the right indications. And we, you know, the government is operating within a budgetary constraint, and these can be costly, especially if they're used in the wrong way or overused or abused. So I do think that there is a role for AI to help weed out the bad actors and the overuse, and you know, potentially to recoup on the fraudulent side. But I think right now, you know, the settings have been kind of overly aggressive, and how we, you know, AI is so new in general. I think it's kind of a new tool that really needs to be, you know, fine-tuned in the proper way. The idea, I think, is that there is a person or a human kind of overreading this or making sure that the denials are appropriate. And so hopefully that's the case, and that may be what we're seeing how in terms of how things are getting better.
So given all of this, I'm wondering what you make of the efforts in Congress by some to do away with WISeR and just scrap it all together.
You know, I did just see that. And, you know, I will admit that part of me was pretty excited about that. I do think that WISeR, when implemented correctly, and if the proper guardrails and oversight are there for it, I do think that it could be a very valuable program. And I think from what I've heard from a couple of the other states where it's been implemented successfully, more in the lines of like a Medicare Advantage plan type of authorization, I think that there is a pretty significant role for it in terms of curbing waste and fraud. So rather than scrapping it, more oversight to make sure that steps are taken to not be a barrier in access to care for patients and that the right patients can get the right treatments that they need. So I think really just having that oversight would be helpful.
All right. Well, Dr. Crooks, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it.
Dr. Matthew Crooks is Director of Interventional Pain Management with Ortho Arizona. He's also president of the Arizona Society of Interventional Pain Physicians. Some wine growers in California are struggling. The New York Times reports some wineries are ripping out or burning their grapes in response to lower sales. There are a number of theories as to why fewer people may be buying and drinking wine, from health concerns to price to taste. With me now to talk about the situation for Arizona wineries is Pavly Milik, the co-owner of the restaurant F&B in Scottsdale and a winemaker with Los Milik's Vineyards. Pavly, good morning.
Good morning.
So, are Arizona wineries in a similar situation, obviously on a much smaller scale than California, but is the situation kind of similar here as it is to our with our neighbors to the west?
Well, I think the story, it's quite different in Arizona. Now, mind you, and I should contextualize it based on the history of the last 3 years. For example, in 2023-24, and to a lesser degree in 2025, we had amazing bountiful harvests, which means this year I have heard of some growers that are not necessarily selling as much fruit as they have in the past. But I got to tell you, and I have to sort of bring in the context and the story of F&B. One change that we've seen, especially over the last 2 or 3 years, is not so much that the wine consumption, the wine purchases at F&B still sort of are at the top of the spear, but guests are beginning to ask more about non-alcoholic options, whether it's things that we carry like Foni Negroni or Athletic Brewing. But when it comes to Arizona wine, and specifically Los Milik's Vineyards, we have not personally experienced sort of the bad news that we're seeing coming from California and even other regions.
Is it surprising to you what you're seeing happening in California?
Well, I think that especially being in the business, it's the news is not good. I will say this, and I have friends in California that are obviously, they know that there is a correction and there is a decrease in consumption. But, you know, conversely speaking, or at least in my experience, most of the wines that we produce at Los Milik's are sold within state lines. And by that, I mean, in terms of scale, we've never had to sort of compete with, and again, this is a slightly reductive sort of explanation, but
sure,
we never had to compete with places like California, Oregon, Washington, Finger Lakes, Europe, or South America, for that matter. Because Arizona wine, although anymore there's over 156 federally bonded and licensed wineries, has always been a very close-knit, grassroots, sort of a local bore, state pride sort of movement where you still get to experience the human scale to winemaking. And by that, I mean invariably, if you go to a tasting room or a winery, you are going to meet the farmer's sort of a callous hands. I think it's... again, due to the nature of how most of the sales have sort of tracked since I can remember, since even opening up F&B 17 years ago, it's been a pretty sort of local movement. So I think we're still, you know, pretty well positioned. And I say that with more than a modicum of humility. You know, you have to try to stay sort of aware and see what's going on and see if you need to pivot or what needs, you know, what things you need to do.
Well, I mean, is it possible for winemakers to pivot if, for example, you know, people are looking for non-alcoholic drinks instead of, you know, the alcohol in wine? Like, is there a way that you or other, you know, winemakers can do that?
Well, when we talk about the non-alcoholic category, as I mentioned before, we do have guests at F&B that are requesting non-alcoholic offerings, more so than before. It depends on who you talk to about non-alcoholic wine. There are some, it's like a bifurcated, you know, conversation where some winemakers that believe why would you even want to do that? And when was the last time that you actually tasted non-alcoholic wine that was good? And then there are some winemakers that actually see that there's a demographic there that would love to still enjoy sort of the ritual aspect of popping a cork and sitting down without having to deal with, I guess, the aftermath if you overly imbibed, if you will. So it just depends on who you talk to. For us at Los Milix, things that, you know, we try to do, it's this idea of amalgamating, you know, experience, meaning the experience of enjoying architecture, offering food. By that, I mean, you know, we have a restaurant in the winery and service, and then trying to sort of double down on providing additional experiences, whether it's something as, you know, interesting as tarot night, or whether it's yoga on the crush pad. I think at the end of the day, the thing about wine is that it sort of levels the playing field. It brings people together. It's about the conviviality that you create when obviously you pop a cork with friends. But when we talk about this idea of, you know, the health aspects anymore that people are obviously concerned about, and at the heels of the Surgeon General talking about that, you know, no amount of wine is good for you, which I thought was a bit of a draconian assessment. And by that, I mean to provide sort of an opposing framework or angle to this conversation. If we look closely at the work of someone like Dan Buettner in the Blue Zones, where we see this unusual amount of centenarians, for the exception of Loma Linda, where, you know, Seventh-day Adventists, they don't really drink, but everybody else does have, you know, a glass or two every day. I think that when you talk about enjoying wine with food, and when there's a sense of community, and when that's coupled with, you know, eating a relatively speaking healthier diet, and there's movement and there's community, I just don't think you can silo the conversation to just, this is bad for you. I mean, it's been around forever, and I don't think wine is going to go away.
Interesting. All right. That is Pavle Milik, co-owner of the restaurant F&B in Scottsdale. He also is a winemaker with Los Milik's Vineyards. Pavle, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody.
Our next guest this morning has spent her career in the outdoors. Heather Hansman spent years as a river guide and skier in Maine and then Colorado, living her life in the outdoors and loving it. But she never had a lot of women to look up to, heroines whose stories she could emulate in recreation and conservation. So she found them and wrote about their trailblazing stories in her newest book. It's called Fierce Country, the untold story of three women who ignited America's love for the wild. And I spoke with her more about it.
Being a river guide was really like my first real job. I started guiding when I was 18. I went to college in Maine, and there's some really great rivers there, and I worked there. And then I actually moved west because of a guy that I river guided with who got me a job in the mountains of Colorado. So those kind of... Yeah. Working on the river in the summer and then working on the ski mountain in the winter was sort of like my initial line into the outdoor world and the way that recreation and then kind of taking care of all these places really tangle together.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So in this book, which is your third, you are profiling three kind of trailblazing, no pun intended, women in the outdoors, right? You've got this Grand Canyon River runner, Georgie White, a powder skier, Dolores LaChapelle, which is very interesting, and also this ecologist and writer, Anne Labastide. I want to talk a little bit about how you chose these women and what you were drawn to about each of them.
In some ways, I think, and there are so many women that I think I could have written about or talked about. There's, you know, one of the gists of the story is that we don't tell hero stories about women in the outdoor world, and they kind of get left out of the narrative. But these three women in particular kind of kept showing up in my life in ways that I didn't even realize until after I'd kind of looked back on them. Like Dolores is in my last book. Georgie showed up in the research for my first book, which is about water in the West. So they'd been kind of like sitting below the surface in a lot of ways. And then, you know, the book is about these women, and they have these wild, they all have these totally wild adventure stories. Like Georgie swam through the Grand Canyon before people were really rafting it. But they also have this kind of underlying line of taking care of the place. You know, Anne LaBastide was, she was a mountain guide. She was kind of taking people into the wilderness in upstate New York, but she was also an ecologist. She was pretty pivotal in the Clean Air Act. She had this endangered bird that she kind of ran this whole campaign to protect. They're like were really dedicating their lives to being outside and the physical side of things, but they also had this kind of like deeper ethic of care. So taken together, their stories kind of gave me this complete picture.
Yeah, and as you say there, you probably could have chosen a lot of women whose stories have not been told here. I want to ask about the story of Georgie White in particular, since this is an Arizona story and she was in the Grand Canyon. And you know, probably felt a personal connection to this one, right? As someone who has done river rafting in the past. Tell us about her. Like, swimming through the Grand Canyon is a pretty wild thing to do. And I'm sure back then it was as well.
I had heard about Georgie, since, I started guiding in Maine before I moved west, but even there, the Grand Canyon has this like mystique. That's like the place where it's like the biggest, longest trip, the biggest water. So I kind of was hearing Grand Canyon stories from the get-go, and Georgie's story kind of came up in that, but it was always as a novelty. Like she had this larger than life persona. She was known for, she always wore a leopard print. She only hired, hot firefighters as her guides. Like she had all these kinds of like novelty things that she did. So I kind of had heard that. And then as I started thinking about it more, and also, one of the other underlying questions of this book was like, why didn't I have heroes and role models, and who could those people have been? And so I started really looking more into Georgie, and she was kind of this big personality. She was pretty bullheaded, but she also, had been one of the first people down there. She was the only woman guiding down there for decades. She had taken the most people through the canyon for a really long time. Like she was running trips more than anyone else. She was really pivotal in kind of thinking about tourism and how we promote getting people into wild places. I think because she, I mean, part of it was like she just wanted to be down there as much as possible, and she figured out that if she guided people, she could go way more often.
Yeah,
But
fair
she also really
enough.
wanted to show people this place that she loved so that they could love it too.
Yeah. I wonder, like, for all of these women, how radical was it for them to be in the outdoors in the way that they were, and like how unheard of?
I mean, I think pretty dang unheard of. The fact that Georgie was the only one down there for a long time working and guiding. And it's not that there weren't other people rafting or going on trips, but she was really the only one running a business. And that feels pretty progressive to me. And part of, Anne LaBastille's story is that she'd become a guide, and then she moved to this cabin in the woods and kind of like did all of her research there from this. She was like Thoreau, but actually living on the woods. And she, and that was like before women could get credit cards or like pay down a home loan. She was living by herself. So there's all these sort of like micro barriers that they were facing along the way. One of the other really interesting strands of this for me was like how much of this stuff still exists, and how different and not different are things now. And I
Have you
think a lot of those
experienced that
sort
in
of,
your own experience as a river guide and as a woman, in this field?
yeah, and there have been many circum like I was on staff at a magazine, and it was a skiing magazine, and I was the only woman on staff. And what stories I was handed and what I covered was specific because of that.
Yeah. So, I mean, doing this, like devoting this book to these three women who, did it anyway. Did you find yourself some role models, even if it's a little later on?
Yes, and also I think, part of what was really interesting about this is that these women are all really complicated too. Like Georgie, for instance, was something of a pathological liar. So that made the reporting for this really interesting because I had to kind of go back and fact check all of it. And people told me she was really exclusive to other women. There's also some like bad behavior too. These weren't uncomplicated people. That made them sort of more interesting and more relatable in a lot of ways to me. I think it's so often it's easy to like put a hero up on a pedestal and never want to hear about why they're not great. And I think we've in the outdoor world, we've done that for a long time. And that sort of crumbled in the past, 10 years or so since Me Too movement. Like we now know that somebody like John Muir wasn't perfect. But I think like I'm really inspired by these people, and I also am kind of like I feel like they've shown me like the pieces of how I want to build a life outside.
All right. Heather Hansman, freelance writer, author of the new book, Fierce Country, The Untold Story of Three Women Who Ignited America's Love for the Wild. Heather, thank you very much for coming on the show. Thank you for telling us about yourself and about the book.
Oh, thanks. It was so fun to talk to you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. As wildfires are burning across the country, Flagstaff officials are looking to prevent that kind of catastrophic damage from happening here. And how do they do it? By cutting down trees, a lot of them. So federal and local officials in Coconino County are in the process of thinning out overgrown forests. Now, they've got trees in 1,500 acres near Snowball on the San Francisco Peaks in their crosshairs. Jay Smith is Coconino County's Forest Restoration Director, and he's on the line now to tell us more about their efforts. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming on. So tell us first about these efforts to thin forests near Flagstaff. I was up in Flagstaff earlier in the summer, and you can really notice this. There seem to be a lot of efforts to thin forests where you're cutting down trees here and there underway.
Yeah, we've been working at this for several years now and really had a slow start going through from 2010, 2012, and we lost all of our industry, basically our forest industry. Now it's starting to come back. And mm-hmm. so we're really moving things forward. And we did a lot of modeling of this area, the Upper Rio de Flag watershed north of Flagstaff, and really saw that there's a huge wildfire risk, but then the post-wildfire flooding that comes from that as well. And so the county got involved through our flood control district, working with Coconino National Forest and other entities on other parts of that. If you drive up Highway 180 going towards Grand Canyon, you'll see a huge change in the forest structure because yeah. we've done a lot of thinning.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can tell, right? Like you can drive down a road in parts of Flagstaff and you'll see a forest that's been thinned on one side of the road and one that hasn't on the other side of the road. And the difference is so stark. It always seems counterintuitive, but explain this for us, Jay. Like fighting wildfires for a century has left our forests unhealthy. There are too many trees, right?
Exactly. And what we've done is we've created our own problem by putting all the fires out. This is a fire-adapted ecosystem. Fire is what kept the forest thin for centuries. And then we came in and said, let's put the fires out. And now we have too dense of a forest. And so we're trying to bring it back to a little bit of that natural so that we can reintroduce fire, good fire, into this ecosystem and keep it thinned. But we have to go in and mechanically thin first, because to start a fire right now in a lot of these areas would just be disastrous in our own way of trying to fix the forest. So thin it first, then we can go back and reintroduce fire.
Right. So like a fire starts in a forest that has not been thinned, and it's just going to take off like wildfire, I guess, right? But
exactly.
What happens in a forest that has been thinned? It's more controllable?
Yeah, it just stays on the ground like it's supposed to. It doesn't get up into the canopy very often, and the trees are adapted for that, those mm-hmm. larger diameter trees are adapted for this fire, and we call it a cool fire because it just stays on the ground. It creeps around, and you know, but it's anytime we have these hot days where it's low humidity, high winds, those are disastrous days for fires to start. And so, but having it in a thin forest, we saw this in the pocket fire when it came up through and hit some of the thinned areas, that's mm-hmm. where they were able to control and stop the fire, the forward progress of the fire.
Yeah. So tell us about where you target for thinning around Flagstaff. Like, is it near homes? Is it near the city? Is it obviously we're talking about an area you're aiming to thin near Snowball on the mountain. No one wants to see the San Francisco Peaks up in flames.
Yeah, we have. So we've done a lot of work, and the city of Flagstaff's done a lot of work around the community itself. And we're still looking at, and looking at communities, and we have a community wildfire protection plan that's putting in place to help communities. But what we're looking at from a flood control district is we've dealt with the Schultz fire, the pipeline fire, we've had the museum fire, massive post-fire flooding, where we spent hundreds of millions of dollars in trying to get the watershed back to where it won't flood communities and homes. And so we're trying to be proactive. We got into the Upper Rio de Flag and said, let's start thinning it before we have that. We know it's not when or if, it's when this fire will
yeah.
happen.
Yeah.
And so we want to be ahead of that, and we want to have this area thinned and where we can, you know, not just thinning the trees, but now there's a lot of dead and down trees
mm-hmm.
that fuel that fire on the ground, and we pull that out as well. and really get it back to a more natural state.
Right. I mean, one of the issues here has been how to pay for this, right? Like that, a massive amount of forest that needs thinning, but also there's been no real industry for this. There's no market for the trees in northern Arizona, right? How are we funding this?
Yeah, a lot of it is coming from local and federal tax dollars. This project specifically in the LaRue area that we're calling, it's being mostly funded by the flood control district. So local property taxes are funding it to the tune of about $4.2 million, about $500,000 of federal money put into this. So, I mean, it's not cheap to do. I mean, this is a more difficult area. It's steeper. It's got a lot of rocks in it. So it's more specialized equipment from the local logger that has the contract. So we're willing to invest that when we know that on the opposite side, if it burns and floods, we did the research and the Northern Arizona University's Economic Policy Institute did this for us. It's $2.8 billion of economic impact if we just let it burn.
Right. So you feel like you have to do something, but it does feel like something of a ticking time bomb, right? Like, are you really up against the clock here in terms of when and if that wildfire starts?
Yeah, a lot of sleepless nights during lightning storms and recreation times where we want to make sure that we get this ahead of any wildfires. And we've thinned about 12,000 acres now in this 21,000 acre watershed. Mm-hmm. So I am sleeping a little bit better at night, but I'm ready to get this last little piece here done. And then a lot of it, we have 5,000 acres of wilderness
right
in this watershed. And, you know, those are where we can't get equipment into those areas. And so there's still going to be some risk, but we have really reduced that risk.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Jay Smith, Coconino County's Forest Restoration Director, joining us. Jay, thank you for coming on the show. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much.
As climate change becomes more of a lived reality for us all, more of us are experiencing climate grief, a sense of loss, and existential anxiety about what's to come. Well, a new breed of spiritual caregivers are stepping in to help, and they're called eco-chaplains. The care they offer is for anyone, from those who are involved in the climate world, like environmentalists, activists, community organizers, the journalists who cover it, or even disaster survivors. Think of it as landing somewhere between professional pastoral care and spiritual practice. Nikayla Jefferson is one of them. She's a Buddhist eco-chaplain, as well as a writer, and she wrote about eco-chaplaincy for Yale Climate Connections. I spoke with her about it earlier this year, and she told me her story with eco-chaplaincy began in 2019 when she was working as an organizer for the Sunrise Movement, a political action nonprofit focused on climate change.
When you're working on an issue like climate change, it's not long before the existential elements really begin to sink in. And I found myself really, for the first time, grappling with something like mass extinction and the end of life as I know it. And I was, you know, I'm 29 now. I was 22 at the time. And there was just felt like no ground beneath my feet. I felt like there was no place I could go to sort of like process this grief and kind of come to terms with things. So I had a spiritual crisis of sorts. And through the journey of that, that's how I found this program and finding an inner commitment to help others who are having some spiritual existential challenges stemming from this transformation of our planet that we're experiencing right now.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like you discovered this maybe sooner than most folks, because this is, you know, becoming, I think, more recognized now, this idea of climate grief that you're describing, this existential crisis that many of us are trying to grapple with. I don't think most people kind of identify what that is. Mm. How did you come to terms with it? Like, when you started studying this, have you resolved this for yourself, or is this ongoing?
No, I don't know anyone who's resolved it. Mm-hmm. It is a lifelong journey. You know, one I'll be in for as long as I'm a human on this planet Earth.
Yeah.
But I feel like now I've arrived in a place where I feel grounded and safe and secure enough in myself and the people around me and this land that I'm on and my home, that I feel a certain degree of confidence that I'll be okay, kind of no matter what heads my way.
So let's talk about being an eco chaplain and what this looks like and this kind of emerging field that seems pretty small still. I think it's interesting that this is coming as like a religious or spiritual kind of guidance as opposed to like from the counseling psychology world in a more secular way. And it seems like this is, you know, an interfaith practice.
Mm-hmm. What I love about eco chaplaincy is we're really just trained to be really great spiritual friends to whoever may come our way in need. And I think we all sort of make use of our individual gifts and abilities and lean into whatever life experiences that we've had up to this point.
Yeah.
So, I mean, some people lead like nature-based workshops for groups, may guide like an earth-based meditation, leading a ritual or a ceremony. And this can, you know, be from like a wedding day up to like honoring a landscape that was lost after a wildfire. People may show up and support activists and organizers as they're, you know, working on a campaign or a protest. Eco-chaplains really just go wherever there is a need and they show up as a spiritual friend the best they can. And it looks different for everybody.
So talk about what it is that you hear from folks who seek out this kind of care. Are they depressed? Are they anxious?
Yeah, I think there are some people who are really aware that their anxiety, their grief, the distress, the pain that they're in right now is related to the climate and ecological changes. But there are some people who are carrying pain and grief that is related, but they're unaware. I was talking to Chris Godot-Jones, who's in this piece. He's a psychotherapist and also a chaplain of the traditional variety. But he was telling me that a lot of his clients may come in about something, you know, about a relationship or a job. And when they begin to unpack the grief or the anxiety or like a sense of loss, climate change is like lingering somewhere in the background. And he told me that, you know, once he kind of names and normalizes, you know, eco anxiety or grief, it really gives people the space to open up about it in a way they felt like, you know, they haven't been able to, either because, you know, maybe there's a stigma around it, maybe they weren't aware of it.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. One of the things that came to mind for me here when I was reading your piece and also just kind of thinking about this topic is that I know many people, I think, around my generation, like the millennial generation, who have decided not to have kids. And they'll say because of climate change, you know, because they're too scared about the future of the world. I mean, do you see things like that come up in conversation?
I mean, yeah, I'm one of them. Absolutely. There's just no right answer. And as the eco chaplain, like I'm not there to give somebody an answer. Yeah. I'm really just there to create space for them to find an answer for themselves.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you mind telling us personally when you think about, you know, the idea of having children, what does that bring up for you? And I'm sure those are common themes in the work that you do.
Yeah. I mean, on one hand, like, you know, I really try to stay in the present, but when it comes to the topic of children, like I can't help but jump like 40 years, you know, down the line here and imagine for like better or worse what life could look like on this earth. And the imaginations, you know, they go both ways. Either we've really figured it out and we're living in this time of like wonder and abundance and possibility, or things have taken a turn for the worst. And we're living in a moment right now that I feel like it truly could go either way. So I feel like my answer to this question is really going to be shaped by whatever happens over the next, like, you know, 3 to 5 years.
That's really interesting. It does feel like a moment like that. So let me ask you then, like, as you're trying to, you know, hear people and be with them in these moments and help them come to their own conclusions about how they would like to address this issue, can you, do you often try to encourage them to take action in small ways? I hear a lot of people say that with climate change, like, you know, do the things that you can do in your own community and that will help you feel better about this big existential problem. Because it is, in the end, like, not a problem that each of us individually can solve.
Right. I'll say, as an eco chaplain, I really try to hold not being prescriptive. You know, I don't want to tell anybody what to do. I think when you try to tell somebody what to do, often you encounter walls. But I also think that, doing something, it feels good. It's empowering. Being with others when you're doing something, it feels even better. So I feel like oftentimes I don't need to tell anybody to do that.
Yeah.
I think if you allow someone to follow the wisdom within for enough time, I think a lot of people end up there eventually on their own. And when you arrive at something on your own, you feel so much more, it feels like your own truth. And I think people being grounded in their own truth and acting from that truth is, I think it's one of the most beautiful things that I can do.
Yeah. All right. I think that's a good place to end it. We'll leave it there. That is Nikayla Jefferson, a writer as well as a Buddhist eco chaplain, joining us to tell us more about that field. Nikayla, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for discussing this with me. I really
Oh,
appreciate it.
thank you so much, Lauren.
All
Great to
right.
be here.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.